From Louisiana to Oregon, Texas to Wyoming, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, faith-based voters have played a pivotal role in past presidential elections. Will they again be decisive in 2020? Timothy Head from the Faith and Freedom Coalition is here to discuss. Congress will be returning to session after Labor Day, facing a full agenda, including a potential fourth stimulus package. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. All that spending on programs to blunt the economic fallout from the COVID-19 shutdown has ballooned the national debt. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And the left is serious about its campaign to defund the nation's police forces, and that is a very dangerous idea. So says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The media focus this presidential election has been elsewhere, but waiting in the wings are faith-based, particularly evangelical voters who often play a decisive role. Timothy Head is executive director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, and he is here to discuss the impact of faith-based voters on this year's election. Tim, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Tim, let's talk about the role of evangelical voters in this upcoming presidential election. There's been a lot of chatter about various blocks of voters on the left, and evangelicals, which in many past elections were talked about extensively, a lot less so this year. Before we talk about the size and role of such voters, tell us what we mean by the term evangelical voter.
Good question. So the evangelical moniker is actually kind of a political science term that political scientists and data miners, if you will, have used for probably 40 years. And it's used to describe, for the most part, Protestant Christians in America. And then with even within Protestantism, there are certain denominations these days that some refer to as mainline Protestants, and then others that a lot of theological and sociological studies refer to as evangelicals. So they're slightly more they're more on the conservative or orthodox end of the theological Christian perspective. So Southern Baptist would be the largest example of that in the country, but a number of other sort of orthodox conservative Protestant churches.
If we were to add together the evangelical Christians along with, as you've mentioned, mainline Protestants and also Catholics, the religious vote overall, in past elections, how important has that vote been?
You could actually argue it's basically the whole shooting match. So in the last election in 2016, the presidential election, there were the entire electorate, not the Republican electorate, the entire electorate, about 27% of the electorate was self-identified evangelical, and then another 9% were self-identified Roman Catholic. So for a total of a little over 36% of the entire electorate, they were self-described faith-based voters, and Donald Trump got 81% of those, according to Faith and Freedom Coalition's ASA polling.
In terms of issues, Tim, that animate this particular part of the electorate, what sort of values do they place the highest priority on, and which candidate is talking more to those values?
Well, the number one motivating issue for evangelicals and faithful Catholics these days is the life question. So when we talk about a pro-life candidate, really, in terms of his policies now, there really isn't a whole lot of argument that Donald Trump has established himself probably as the most pro-life candidate and actual office holder in the history of American politics since 1973 in the advent of Roe versus Wade. Vice President Biden, historically, if you rewind several years now, he actually was, I would consider him a pro-life moderate Democrat until probably the 90s when he started to drift. And at this point, I think it's a bit of a farce to consider him pro-life. Other issues that are certainly resonate among faithful voters include religious liberty, which historically has been more of an international issue in terms of persecuted Christians or persecuted people of faith across the world. But unfortunately, that's becoming more and more relevant for us here at home. We're seeing churches, being shut down or ostracized, even here and now. Recent situations in California and Birmingham, Alabama, and Tampa, Florida, where churches, where pastors have been arrested or churches closed because of not abiding sufficiently distancing rules, et cetera. Other issues might include human trafficking. Certainly, issues related to Israel are paramount issues for a lot of faith-based voters. There's a bit of a wide panoply of issues that that Christians pay attention to, but they tend to center on biblically spelled out principles that really are near and dear to so many of us.
An issue that we see emerging as perhaps what's going to be the pivotal issue in this election, with all the violence and the rioting and the looting and the destruction that's taking place in Democrat-controlled cities around the country, the whole issue of law and order, in fact, the issue of personal safety, has become front and center. Do you see this as an issue that is going to rise up on the list of priorities for faith-based voters as well?
Absolutely. Even in our own, we've been polling and doing surveys as we go house to house across the country for Faith and Freedom Coalition. And the economy, so the recovery from the recession induced via COVID restrictions, is number one. And number two is basically a return to law and order and to a civil society. So I think it's absolutely front and center. But not only are evangelical and Catholic voters interested in this, but honestly, I think you're even seeing now moderate or unperforming voters are even becoming animated by this that otherwise might not have even voted.
As you mentioned, there's a large segment of the electorate that self-identify as evangelical or faith-based voters. So what about turnout, Tim? Even if somebody identifies as such a voter, these issues are important. They are issues that the president speaks to. If people don't show up at the polls, their vote doesn't count. So as with the efforts on the left, is there an effort going on to get these voters to the polls here, either to the polls in November or by all the many mail-in balloting that's going to be taking place? Is there an organized effort to get these folks to have their votes count?
There absolutely is. So there are a number of organizations that that focus now on faith-based voters. And at this point, a lot of people consider Faith and Freedom Coalition to be the preeminent effort for that. So we've continued to engage Christians across the country at an escalating level every single election cycle. And this will be the largest of our almost 12 years of existence. So we are just now surpassing 1 million doors that our volunteers across the country have visited in person. We will ultimately visit 5 million households in person across the country. And eventually we will touch, we'll have about 225 million voter contacts through a range of mediums. So we are strongly educating and urging people of faith across the country to get out and have their voice heard.
We have been talking with Tim Head, who is executive director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. So you've told us a bit about what the Faith and Freedom Coalition is doing relative to this election. But Tim, give us an overview as to what the Faith and Freedom Coalition is and what you do.
Well, we like to say that our role is to give Christians a voice in government. So whether that is in state houses or in Washington, D.C., in Congress, lobbying for issues related to life, to family, to religious liberty, to Israel, to other issues that are core to our faith, or on the streets of America, educating people of faith and churches on where candidates stand on these critical issues. We exist to educate and to energize people of faith to be effective citizens.
And where can folks go on the web to learn more?
You can learn more about us at www.ffcoalition.com.
Tim Head, Executive Director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Tim, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. God bless.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, in addition to keeping an eye on all the major political developments that have been occurring in recent weeks, also is our eyes on the nation's capital, where Congress will be returning for a couple of weeks here in September. So we're going to talk about the legislative agenda today. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Loman. Thanks for having me.
One of the big issues, Scott, a lot of people are asking, and it's sort of fallen off the radar screen with all the national conventions and everything occurring in the last few weeks, this whole idea of a phase four package, stimulus, as some people call it, to deal with the economic impact of the COVID-19 crisis. Are there still ongoing talks, and what is the status of that package?
Negotiations really broke down about a month ago between Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell, Mark Meadows, and Steve Mnuchin. But I think the Republicans have still kind of dug in on their side and have been proactively talking about what a package could look like in September. But we do need to keep in mind this would be the fourth major iteration. And there was actually a legislation that Congress acted on very early with emergency supplemental funding that went toward the development of a vaccination and paid for PPEs. Then you had the Families First legislation that put that onerous mandate on small businesses to provide for paid leave during the coronavirus pandemic. And then you saw those rounds of the Paycheck Protection Program in phase three, along with unemployment insurance benefits. And that's been a big stickler in the negotiations now. Republicans are basically from a position where they want to offer $300 per week in unemployment insurance benefits that would be expanded upon what a state normally gives out to the unemployed population. And then they also want to do another round of the Paycheck Protection Program for businesses. And they want to have about $105 billion go to governors in education money that can help with the needs of our schools, K-12. So Club for Growth is certainly looking at pro-growth ideas that can accommodate a faster economic recovery that I think right now we're gonna learn here over the next few weeks that the depth of the economic devastation is very, very deep. And so there will be additional pressure on Capitol Hill to get some sort of an agreement. But right now, I'd say that they're about $1.8 trillion apart. Republicans want to do a $500 billion package. Democrats want to do about $2.3 trillion. And how that negotiation unfolds over the next few weeks is something that we all need to keep our eyes on.
Everything, of course, is political, as we are now in the general election cycle, Scott. So for Democrats in particular, who hold the majority in the House of Representatives, does this put Democrat members at risk if they're unable to deliver a stimulus package before the election?
Quite honestly, I think that the House Democrats have just been politically posturing the entire 2 years that they've held the majority. They started out with the impeachment of Donald Trump, and now they're using the coronavirus as a crisis where they can try to extract bigger government out of the Republican Senate and Donald Trump's Republican administration. So I'm not sure that the voters will really hold them responsible for not coming to an agreement on coronavirus, but I do think that there are general election voters that are seeing what's happening across our country in the suburbs in particular and beginning to question which party stands for law and order and safety in the communities. Obviously, there's social justice issues that are percolating that are causing the rioting and the protesting, which are two very different things. But those suburban voters are coming more into play for President Trump and a lot of those battleground states that the Democrats won their majority on in 2018. So as we move through September, we will have a funding deadline on September 30th. I would imagine that they would pass a continuing resolution through December, which is the lame duck session of Congress following the election. And that'll be also the vehicle that could accommodate a final negotiation between Republicans and Democrats, since we do have divided government. But, you know, you've also got Nancy Pelosi out there getting her hair done in a salon while, you know, that salon was forced to be closed in San Francisco. We're not talking about a right-wing salon, right? We're talking about a business that is basically devastated because of the policy positions of the Democrats to keep the economy closed. So a safe reopening and one that doesn't increase risk for those that are at risk due to the pandemic, I think is going to be a top-line message that a lot of the Republicans want to focus on over the next 8 weeks.
Also in the month of September, Scott, we have the presidential and vice presidential debates that are going to take place. The big question is, will Joe Biden actually show up and do these debates? What are your thoughts on that? And how important are these debates for both the president and for Joe Biden?
The schedule was announced this week for the presidential debates and the vice presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Vice President Mike Pence. Those will be a real opportunity for the Biden camp and the Trump campaign to sort of take the gloves off and go head-to-head. I think that you've got some of the Democratic leaders that think Joe Biden doesn't need to show up to these debates. His campaign has said he will show up. He obviously knows that there's a big tradition there with our system of government to have these big primetime presidential debates, and they did agree on the dates for those to occur. I think one will be in late September and two of those will be in October. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The Congressional Budget Office now reports that the national debt is set to exceed the annual size of the U.S. economy. We learn more from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
When the federal government's fiscal year ends on the last day of September, America's national debt will nearly match the size of the U.S. economy for the first time since the end of World War II. That's according to projections from the Congressional Budget Office released this week. They show that the national debt will equal roughly 98% of America's gross domestic product, or GDP. That is a rough measurement of the overall size of the country's economic output. And by early in the next fiscal year, the national debt will have tipped over that important line, and we will have achieved 100% debt-to-GDP ratio. That's territory that only a few other countries have ever gone into during peacetime, and their examples, places like Italy and Greece, are not ones that we should be excited to be following. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at this rather eye-popping and alarming report from the Congressional Budget Office this week showing that the United States' march towards that 100% debt-to-GDP ratio level has accelerated, and it's accelerated in large part because of trillions of dollars in emergency spending that have been approved since March to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. But of course, the national debt has really been rising for more than two decades now. You have to go back all the way to the late 90s to find the last time that the federal budget was balanced. And it has, of course, surged this year because of the coronavirus response spending, because the federal budget deficit has just exploded in the last few months. The budget deficit, of course, that's the gap between what the government spends and how much it collects in tax revenue in a single year. The CBO now says that the deficit for this year, the fiscal year that will end on September 30th, is going to be somewhere around $3.3 trillion. That is more than three times larger than the budget deficit for the fiscal year that ended last September. And just for comparison's sake, the budget deficit in the month of June alone this year, in June of 2020, exceeded every annual budget deficit during the George W. Bush administration. Now, this national debt, this budget deficit problem is not a new one. The budget deficit has been rising the past several years. The national debt has tipped north of $20 trillion, then $22, then $23 trillion, and so on. All of that was in motion before the coronavirus got here. In fact, spending under President Donald Trump has surged by about $937 billion in less than 4 years. That's actually more than it went up or under Barack Obama during the 8 years that Obama was president. We've actually seen a greater increase in federal spending in just 4 years under President Donald Trump. Now, that's not all Trump's fault, of course. Congress is largely responsible for setting federal spending, but the Republicans and Democrats that have controlled Congress during Trump's tenure have shown no interest whatsoever in reining in the amount of money the federal government spends or in trying to balance the budget. The last time the United States borrowed as much as it has borrowed in the last few years, that was during World War II, the country then ran about a decade of balanced budgets to get back on the right path during the late 40s and 1950s. But today, that seems increasingly unlikely to happen because it's not as if we're just going to turn off the switch of federal spending the way we did at the end of World War II, because the thing that is driving the federal budget deficit today is not a war. It's not even the pandemic. It's actually the rising health and retirement costs that are connected to entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare. In a separate report that was also released Wednesday, the CBO projected that the federal trust fund for those three entitlement programs will actually fall by about $43 billion in the current fiscal year. That's because the economic downturn caused by the coronavirus has caused payroll taxes, which fund those entitlement programs, to decline. And unless Congress takes action, those trust funds will now be exhausted within 10 years, a shorter horizon than was previously expected, according to the CBO. Meanwhile, Congress continues to debate the short-term question of whether to spend even more money in response to the coronavirus crisis. The House has passed a $3.5 trillion stimulus bill, but Senate Republicans have blocked up its passage, in part because they're concerned, and rightfully so, about whether America can afford to continue to borrow so heavily to combat the coronavirus when we already can't pay for the spending that's on the books. In short, this combination of things, a combination of short-term crises like the coronavirus and long-term problems like how to pay for Social Security and other entitlement programs, all of that is combining to teach, I think, a very valuable lesson about the fact that the debt crisis is no longer some sort of hypothetical future event off in the distance that might someday arrive. It is a thing that is now very much starting to impact the day-to-day and year-to-year budgetary processes in Washington, and it's going to trickle down to the state and local levels as well. A persistently high level of debt almost certainly means that the amount of economic growth that we will see in coming years is going to be reduced because the debt is going to act as a drag on the economy. It means that the amount of money the federal government can spend to stimulate the economy is going to be limited when there are downturns. And it almost certainly means that there are reduced options for policymakers when it comes to addressing America's long and short-term crises. It means there's less money available when something happens out of the blue, like the coronavirus. And it also means there are fewer good options when it comes to having to solve the problem like how to pay for the long-term entitlement programs that the federal government runs. Unfortunately, America missed its chance to get the debt and deficit under control. We just came out of a period of 10 years of solid economic growth. The federal government squandered that instead of balancing the budget, instead of putting money away, instead of putting us in a position where we could have had more flexibility to address whatever crisis might have been the next one to come. Instead, we saw budget deficits inflate. We saw the national debt climb to new highs, and the coronavirus has pushed us right to the edge of now carrying a national debt that is as large as the entire American economy. And that's a situation that is not going to resolve itself anytime soon, even if the virus disappears tomorrow. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bam. You can check out more of our coverage of the coronavirus, of the debt crisis, of everything else that we're working on at Reason.com. And I'll be right back here next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
When left-wing groups say they want to defund the police, they mean exactly what they are saying, and that is a dangerous idea. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College discusses the issue on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The aftermath of the sad death of George Floyd has unfortunately led to another wrong, and that is the perception of too many police officers as villains. Police are feeling it, painfully. Many of these police are blaming not just bad police, but Black Lives Matter for its language regarding police. Consider an email that I recently received from Joe, a former student of mine at Grove City College, class of 2003. He emailed me for the first time in years, quite upset. He wrote, quote, "As a police officer, I see firsthand the damage that Black Lives Matter is causing," unquote. He was referring specifically to calls to defund the police. What calls? Well, here you go. Quote, "We call for a national defunding of police," unquote. candidly states Black Lives Matter at its website under its hashtag Defund the Police. Quote, if you're with us, add your name to the petition and help us spread the word, unquote. Therein, under the tab, what defunding the police really means, BLM leads with this terrible stereotype. Quote, we know that the police don't keep us safe, unquote. Yes, let me reread that. We know that police don't keep us safe. That's what Black Lives Matter actually says. That's a remarkable assertion that angers, guess who? Police, including black police. It also angers black residents and communities who feel that the police do keep them safe. Asked about defunding the police, David Clark, the former sheriff of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, who's African American, states emphatically, quote, the biggest losers in all of this will be poor black people in crime-ridden ghettos. The police are the only thing standing between them and violent criminal predators. You'd have to loathe black people, says David Clark, to do that to them. For the record, I've personally emailed with BLM defenders who say the call for defunding can mean different things to different people. And yet, if that's the case, if BLM doesn't mean defund the police, but say reform the police, then why not change hashtag defund the police to hashtag reform the police? If you don't want to defund the police, then don't create slogans saying defund the police. And yet the likes of BLM activist Miski Noor insist that when fellow activists like her say they want to abolish the police, they, quote, 100% mean that they want no more police. Well, police certainly interpret it that way. And how do you expect police, sensitive about their difficult, dangerous jobs, to react to language like defund the police and we know that police don't keep us safe? For police like my former student Joe, this isn't helpful. For the first time in my 15-plus year career, Joe told me, I feel I can understand what the soldiers returning from Vietnam experienced upon returning to a thankless country. Yes, I can imagine. All Joe ever wanted to be was a policeman. While other Grove City College students went to law school or medical school or took glamorous jobs in New York or Washington or L.A., Joe went to police school. Joe learned how to chase down bad guys who hurt people. He viewed police heroically, and now he feels helpless. For the record, both myself and friends have had experiences with bad cops. We all have. I know guys who were abused. In my case, white cops abusing white guys. I personally had a moment with a police officer in Sacramento a few years ago that was shocking and scary. The guy was obviously having a lousy day and just snapped. I've observed police behavior not exactly exemplary. But of course, as the saying goes, you can't let a few bad apples ruin the entire bushel. Countless police devote themselves selflessly. Most people don't go to work fearing a bullet in the head and never seeing their kids again. Police are under tremendous stress, and they are, yes, human. And so, stop the bad cops, stop the abusers, sure, reform the police, but above all, please understand that not all cops are bad cops. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kangor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WHLM-AM in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, WSOY-AM in Decatur, Illinois, along with WKCT-AM in Bowling Green, Kentucky. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.